Okay. Well, thank you, Tony, for that very flattering introduction. When the theory of quantum gravity is written about by historians of science, the last 20th of the 20th century will be identified as the era of the string duality revolution. This was a period in which we learned an enormous amount about string theory, and particularly we turned it from a purely perturbative theory to a theory about which we had a lot of non-perturbative information. We made connections with supergravity, with black hole physics, and a host of other areas. And one of the curious things about the aftermath of this revolution is that if you look at string theorists coming out of it, they all have different opinions about what the most important thing was that we learned in this revolution. And so today I'm going to talk about what I think is the most important thing that we've learned from this revolution. My talk is going to have two parts. The first part, I'm going to talk about facts that I think most string theorists would agree with, and the only thing radical about it will be my interpretation of those facts. The most controversial thing I think I'm going to say is that I think that string theory is actually a collection of different mathematically consistent models of quantum gravity, which all make sense as mathematical theories, but most of them don't really describe the world that we see around us. And then the second part of the talk, if I get to it, I will talk about some guesses about a hypothetical theory which describes a space-time with a positive cosmological constant, an asymptotically de Sitter space. And if recent observations are correct, that's a better description of the real world that we live in than any of the models of string theory that we have at present. So to make a theory like that, we would have to generalize the present framework of string theory. And I'll tell you about some guesses about what that theory might look like. Now, a major issue in everything that I'm going to say is going to be the problem of the cosmological constant. And even though we're string theorists, our thinking about this problem is based on an older paradigm called effective field theory in a background spacetime. This is a framework which was developed jointly, really, by condensed matter physicists and by elementary particle physicists to describe the long wavelength behavior of any quantum system in a fixed background geometry. Condensed matter physicists, of course, usually think just about flat space, but the generalization to a fixed background geometry is not too hard. And these kinds of field theories always intrinsically come with a length scale cutoff. They aren't supposed to be good down to arbitrarily short wavelengths. There's some underlying dynamics which is more general than the field theory and reduces to the field theory for long wavelengths. Now, in quantum gravity, there's a number that Planck first introduced. Quantum gravity gives you a natural unit of length. And so it was natural thinking in effective field theory language that we should think about the underlying theory of quantum gravity as sort of a short distance modification of effective field theory. And that that was all it was, and at length scales much longer than the Planck length, or 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, we would use effective field theory thinking. Well, another thing that was again developed jointly by condensed matter and particle physicists was the idea of how you use this idea of effective field theory to understand what the most general kind of long wavelength effective Lagrangian could be. And the key concept there is the concept of relevant operators. Namely, when you have a theory which has an intrinsic length scale which is much, much smaller than the wavelengths that you're actually measuring in the laboratory, you find that all of the details of the parameters of the underlying theory get encapsulated in just a few numbers that characterize the long wavelength behavior. Those numbers, typically, when I express them in units of the fundamental length scale, behave like negative powers of the length. They blow up in the limit that I take that length scale to zero. And so they have to be, in order to understand the long wavelength behavior, they have to be fine-tuned. And condensed matter physicists and quantum cosmologists have a rather different attitude to how to think about that fine tuning. For condensed matter physicists, the system that he's studying is some system in the laboratory, and the experimenter has control over it, and he can fine tune parameters at will by changing the external conditions, and in particular can make the system undergo a second order phase transition in which it gets very, very long wavelength fluctuations. And so a condensed matter physicist is very content with that sort of fine tuning of parameters. Whereas someone who thinks that he's dealing with a theory of the entire universe has a different kind of problem when thinking about a fine tuning of parameters in his theory. Where does it come from? Who does it? What are we talking about here? Why doesn't this parameter have a natural value that describes what we actually see in the real world? Well, the cosmological constant is simply the most relevant parameter that exists in any effective field theory. Condensed matter physicists will be used to the fact that when I calculate the effective Hamiltonian using the renormalization group for long wavelengths, that the vacuum energy, or what they call the free energy, is something that comes out of order the fundamental length scale to the minus d power of the space-time dimension. That's just basically dimensional analysis. And the cosmological constant in this framework of effective field theory in background space-time is really nothing but that vacuum energy. In, however, the next step that a quantum cosmologist, but not a condensed matter physicist, would do, it takes on a rather different role. Because the quantum cosmologist knows that one of the things that's not right about just taking a fixed background space-time is that Einstein taught us that the geometry of space-time is dynamical. It satisfies equations. In a fixed space-time, a vacuum energy, background ground state energy that depends on what the background geometry is, doesn't do anything because I've fixed the background geometry. But if I now think of the background geometry as a dynamical quantity, then that enters into the equations of the background geometry. And in particular, it enters in this form that Einstein called the cosmological constant in Einstein's equations. It's a form of energy that's a constant proportional to the stress tensor of space-time itself. So if I use this philosophy of effective field theory, I would guess that that coefficient lambda should be of order the Planck length to the minus fourth power. Now, recently, we may have measured lambda. Until that time, we had bounds on lambda. The current measurement is still at least a bound. And the observed bound is 120 orders of magnitude smaller than this natural expectation. So that's the puzzle that we're trying to understand. Now, of course, in effective field theory, you can always understand that puzzle by fine-tuning the bare parameters. But the question is, why should I do that? Normally, when I look at parameters in a long wavelength effective Lagrangian, they have natural values. And when they don't, I seek for an explanation. So let's keep this in mind. There's one more thing about the general framework, the philosophy of effective field theory I want to mention, that lambda, the vacuum energy, is generally calculated as the minimum of an effective potential. The effective potential depends on various low energy fields. Condensed matter physicists can think of these as order parameters that the system has. And you think of it as just the Legendre transform of the energy that you get when you couple a background constant source term to the order parameter. So it's given by this formula. Typically, in some classical approximation, it'll have this form. And it's got a bunch of minima. And in effective field theory, I think of those minima as different states of the same theory. They are classical approximations to different quantum ground states of the theory. And they have the property that if I look at very high energy densities, much larger than the scale of the size of this potential, then all of them look the same. It's a fundamental property of quantum field theory. That's really what we mean when we say that there are different states of the same theory. They have different infrared low-energy behavior, but exactly the same high-energy behavior. And so this paradigm, again, is something that, as string theorists, we've kind of expected to be true, and I'm going to be telling you that it's a very bad distortion of the real facts in a theory of quantum gravity. In particular, over here, there's a little dimple on the potential. I want you to think about this big potential as sort of having a typical very high energy scale, like the Planck mass to the fourth, and then this little dimple is a little correction that comes from low energy physics. And we would have, according to the conventional picture, different states of the theory with different values of the cosmological constant, namely the value of the potential at its minimum, and they would all be part of the same theory. And I'm going to tell you that that's just simply a wrong picture. So the first indication that this is wrong comes from very general considerations of quantum measurement theory that indicate that there can't be any precisely defined quantum mechanical observables in a theory of quantum gravity. So here's a kindergarten version of the modern quantum theory of measurement. The old Copenhagen theory introduced classical objects in some mysterious way and collapse of the wave function. But in the modern theory of measurement, what you think of doing is taking an ordinary quantum mechanical unitary evolution and making a correlation between some microscopic observable, like the spin up or down of a spin a half particle, and a big macroscopic observable, like the polarization of a huge ferromagnet. And then you say that, well, indeed it's true that the huge ferromagnet is still a quantum system, and there can be quantum tunneling and interference between states where the ferromagnet is polarized up and the ferromagnet is polarized down, but the ferromagnet doesn't make such quantum jumps very, very often, and we don't really have to worry too much about that interference. So the only complicated thing about this story is how you amplify the microscopic thing to be macroscopic, and of course we do that with all kinds of complicated machines. Here's a typical amplification device. Here we have Schrodinger's cat looking at spin up and spin down. Depending on which one he sees, he gives a tiny little flick of his tail, sets in motion a complicated process which eventually polarizes an electromagnet either one way or the other way. And that makes a correlation between the spin up and spin down and the polarization of the magnet. So what's problematic about this idea? What's problematic about this idea is that in order to get mathematically precise answers from quantum mechanics, in order to interpret the mathematical formalism as corresponding to something real that you actually could measure, or the limit of something you actually measure, you have to think about the ferromagnet becoming infinite. Because it's only in that limit that I can completely neglect the quantum fluctuations of the ferromagnet itself. Now, in a theory without gravity, I don't care about infinite ferromagnets. I can arrange imaginary systems in which they don't interact very much. But in a theory with gravity, an infinite ferromagnet will weigh an infinite amount, and it will interact gravitationally with the experiment that I'm trying to measure, and it'll change the experiment. And so the only way that I can get away with an infinite ferromagnet in a theory that contains gravity is to move it off to infinity. And in order for that to be true, space-time has to have infinite spatial boundaries that I can move it off to. And this suggests that the only real observables in a theory of quantum gravity that are mathematically precisely defined will be observables associated with infinite boundaries of the space-time. And that conventional local observables may exist in some approximation, but they can't be part of the precise mathematical formalism of the theory.
So space or space-time boundary?
The boundary is a boundary. In general, you have to talk about a boundary of space-time. As you'll see, there are different kinds of space-time where the boundaries have different characteristics. And I'll talk about that in two examples. So this idea is one of the things we mean when we say that theories of quantum gravity are holographic theories. All of the variables, all of the actual measurable quantities are encoded on a d minus one dimensional surface at the boundary. And things that go on in the bulk are somehow little pale images of things that are going on the boundary. One of the consequences of this is that it doesn't make sense to stick in a constant source over all of space-time, because sources can only couple to exact observables, and those live only on the boundary. And so this means that as long as the effective potential is not exactly equal to zero, it probably doesn't have an exact meaning in the theory. For zero momentum particles, for massless particles, where the effective potential is exactly equal to zero, you can think of a constant source as a limit of a physical wave packet off at the boundary, because the physical wave packets have k squared, the 4 momentum squared, equal to zero, and k equals zero, a constant source, can be thought of as a limit of that. Okay. So now that's some general philosophy, but here are some examples that tell you that this is in fact what goes on. So the big thing that we really know now from the last 15 years of string theory is, no, it's more like 19 years of string theory now, isn't it? That we now understand that there are lots of very precise things that we can calculate in models of quantum gravity that actually make mathematical sense. And what are those precise things that we can calculate? Well, in the original versions of string theory, where strings were propagating in asymptotically flat space-time, one of the puzzles of those models, one of the reasons that Gabriele Veneziano discovered them, was because he was looking for a framework in which there was an S matrix, a scattering matrix, but no local observables. And that's in fact what we have in string theory. We only have a scattering matrix. We have no local observables. So in an asymptotically flat space-time, the boundary looks like this. What I've done is to use a trick due to Roger Penrose to take an infinite asymptotically flat space-time and by conformal transformation compress it down into a little diamond-shaped picture. Now that diamond isn't really a diamond. You should think of it as a figure of revolution in d minus two dimensions if the full space-time has d dimensions. And in fact, if I think of it like that, I really only need half of the diamond in this picture because I can get the other half by rotating. And what I've done here, it's sort of like the way Bush's tax cuts distort the economy, okay? The shape of everything is completely screwed up and the sizes of everything are completely screwed up, but you get a really clear picture of the causal connections between things. So in this picture, things are causally connected if they can be connected by light rays, which travel always at exactly 45 degree straight lines on the picture, or if they can be connected by time-like observers, and all the time-like observers get squeezed into this one point at the top of the diagram eventually. And a scattering process is something where I start with some number of sources on past null infinity and past time-like infinity, and I send particles in from there, which then scatter and come out to the boundaries up here. And those are the observables we know how to calculate in asymptotically flat space-times, and they only have to do with the boundary of the space-time. Where's my last? Okay. Now, in case one thought that this was only true of perturbative string theory, in certain cases we have a non-perturbative formulation called matrix theory. And again, the same thing is true. The only observables there are the scattering matrix. The example I want to concentrate on most, though, is not asymptotically flat, but asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime. Anti-de Sitter spacetime is the simplest example, the most symmetric solution of Einstein's equations with a negative value of the cosmological constant. And here's a formula for what the spacetime metric is in anti-de Sitter spacetime. I really only want you to pay attention to this formula in the limit of large R, the asymptotic region, and I'll call a spacetime asymptotically anti-de Sitter if there's a coordinate system where it looks like this for very, very large R. Now, the interesting thing about this coordinate system is that when I take R very large, the R actually factors out of what I've got left. I'm going to r equals infinity, so I drop the r part. I'm going out to the boundary where r equals infinity. And the boundary metric looks like this cylinder. It's a time axis, and then a sphere of radius equal to L. L is called the anti-de Sitter radius, and it's related to the square root of minus the cosmological constant in Planck units. And aside from that simple cylindrical metric, there's just an overall infinite factor of R. And what Penrose's trick corresponds to is doing a rescaling transformation, a conformal transformation that gets rid of that infinite factor and defines what's called the conformal boundary of asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, which is this cylinder. Now, during the string duality revolution, a remarkable discovery was made by Maldacena and Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Witten. Namely, that the observables of an exact theory of quantum gravity in a spacetime with this kind of asymptotics were nothing more nor less than the ordinary correlation functions, or Green's functions, of a quantum field theory that lived on this boundary cylinder. All right. So that's the analog for anti-de Sitter spacetime of the scattering matrix in asymptotically flat spacetime. It's first of all holographic. It's a set of observables associated only with the boundary. And second of all, it's a quantum field theory. That's an object we know a lot about mathematically. We've been studying them now for many years. There's a big difference between this quantum field theory and the kinds of effective quantum field theories I was describing at the beginning of my talk. In this quantum field theory, there's no cutoff. It's an exact mathematical quantum field theory. Ken Wilson taught us that in order for that to be true, the asymptotic short distance and high energy regime of that field theory, where by short distance I mean short distances on this sphere, is described by an exactly conformally invariant. If you don't know what conformal invariance is, just think about scale invariance. An exactly conformally invariant field theory on this spacetime. And it turns out that the statement that the field theory in its ultraviolet is conformally invariant is exactly equivalent to the statement in spacetime that as I go out to the boundary at large r, at large distances, the spacetime becomes this nice, simple anti-de Sitter metric. The conformal group of the boundary is equivalent to the symmetry group of the bulk anti-de Sitter spacetime. That's one of the clues that led these people to this remarkable conclusion about what the quantum theory of gravity looked like. So this is a really interesting, and I think one of the most interesting things that we learned about quantum gravity from the string duality revolution. And the most interesting thing is there's this odd correspondence between the ultraviolet of the theory on the boundary and infrared or large distance behavior in spacetime, in the bulk of spacetime. That's absolutely the opposite connection that we're used to for quantum field theories that live in the bulk of spacetime. In the model of quantum field theory in the bulk of spacetime, all of the high energy stuff came from very, very short distances. Here we're saying that all of the high energy stuff has to do with very, very large spacetime distances. Isn't that peculiar? Okay. So there's a lot of technical stuff here, and I obviously can't tell you all about the technical connections that reinforce and prove to us that this was right and reinforce these connections between ultraviolet and infrared. But I can give you a sort of intuitive picture that explains to you why there's this peculiar ultraviolet-infrared connection. And to do that, I want to, for a moment, go back to asymptotically flat spacetimes and think about scattering processes and think about how, historically, we have probed shorter and shorter distances, shorter and shorter distance scales in spacetime. We've done it by doing scattering experiments at very, very high energies, where very, very high always means higher than the last experiment somebody did, and very, very small impact parameters. This is the way that Rutherford discovered the nucleus in the center of the atom, and this is the way the people who did the deep inelastic scattering experiments at SLAC and MIT discovered quarks inside of the nucleon. We see more and more structure at shorter and shorter distances by doing scattering at higher and higher energies and smaller impact parameters. So let's ask what happens to this progression to short distances in a theory of quantum gravity. And quite remarkably, there's an answer to that question. The answer stems from work originally done by Roger Penrose. A lot of other people have contributed to it, including a number that are sitting in this room. And basically, the message is that this connection between high energies, small impact parameters, and short distance fails once you get to energies of order the Planck mass. Because once you get to energies of order the Planck energy, just for to remember what that number is, it's 10 to the 19th GeV. So it's not something we're likely to do soon unless secretly the Planck scale is much lower than we think it is. And there are some people who believe that that's true. What happens is that there's a new length that comes into the game. Namely, if you have a bunch of energy, there's a Schwarzschild radius associated with that energy, which has the property, if you try to take all that energy and concentrate it in a region smaller than or equal to the Schwarzschild radius, the energy collapses on itself and you form a black hole of that Schwarzschild radius. So there are now very good arguments based on general relativity, that if you do scattering experiments, two miserable little particles, but with very, very high energies, and you take your impact parameter less than the Schwarzschild radius that you calculate from the center of mass energy of the collision, and that's a radius that grows with energy, like a power of the energy. The power depends on the dimension of the space-time, but it's a growing radius. So it's not only true at very, very tiny distances, but for a larger and larger range of impact parameters. Instead of having some hard scattering process, you create a black hole. So here's what it would look like if we were going up in energy. Here's a scattering experiment. And typically, when you get energies bigger than some characteristic scale, say of QCD, and momentum transfers or impact parameters less than 1 over m, then you see point-like scattering in quantum field theory, very simple Feynman diagrams. In a theory of quantum gravity, we see instead that when the energy gets above the characteristic energy scale and b, the impact parameter, is less than the Schwarzschild radius, you instead form a huge black hole. So high energies, you attempt to go to small impact parameters, but instead you make this huge object, connection between high energies, long distances, and the asymptotic behavior of space-time.
What is RS of MP? How big is that?
RS of MP is about the Planck length.
That's
okay, so you have to be way above the Planck scale before you start making huge black holes.
Much bigger than the Planck.
That's right. So the energy at which this kicks in is the Planck scale. And in general, this kind of special scaling behavior always happens when you're way above the characteristic energy scale. And here the scaling behavior is being way above the Planck energy, and then the Schwarzschild radius gets much, much bigger than the Planck length and grows without bound. Now, why should I believe these arguments? They're actually based on general relativity, which we think of as only an effective long wavelength field theory. Well, the reason is because if you look outside the horizon, outside the Schwarzschild radius of a large black hole, the curvature of space-time is very low, and the larger the black hole is, the smaller the curvature is. And so the corrections that we believe exist to general relativity all become very small when the space-time curvature is very, very small. Furthermore, these large black holes not only have low curvature, but according to the results of Bekenstein and Hawking, they have low temperatures and large energies. So these have a number of astounding implications. First of all, as I said, it was valid to use general relativity to draw these conclusions. Secondly, I claim, this says that different states of the same theory don't have the same high energy behavior in a theory of quantum gravity, and therefore I shouldn't think of them as different states of the same theory, but really different theories with different high energy behavior. Let's see how I come to that conclusion. Let me repeat it in a different way. So let's look at my picture. What happens when I scatter and I make a black hole? So you scatter and you make a black hole. When a black hole is very, very large, it just sits there and doesn't do very much. It sits there and it gravitates. If there's matter nearby, it accretes it. But if there's nothing nearby, it just sits there. And then Hawking showed us that that's not quite correct. That's correct to leading order in the mass of the black hole divided by the Planck mass. But when the mass of the black hole is finite, it actually radiates, and it has a temperature that goes like the inverse of its mass in Planck units. Now that temperature, as the mass gets large in this very high energy scattering experiment, is very low. And what Hawking showed us is that the radiation that comes off a black hole is thermal. But if you have thermal radiation with a very low temperature, you're sensitive to the very low energy spectrum of your theory. And we always knew that different, quote, vacuum states had different low energy spectra. And so this says that the high energy behavior is intimately connected with the low energy behavior. You can't separate the two as you do in quantum field theory by going to short distances. In quantum field theory, if I have two different states of the same quantum field theory, once I go up to high enough energy and short enough distance, the difference between scattering amplitudes just disappears. But in a theory of quantum gravity, that's completely untrue. Now, with this intuition, let me now go back to anti-de Sitter space and reinforce this connection even more by telling you about one of the other remarkable results of the string duality revolution. As I told you, Bekenstein and Hawking had identified black holes as having a temperature. Temperature was easy to calculate once Hawking figured out how to do it. But the entropy was kind of mysterious. So the entropy was there, but, and it was needed in order for black holes to satisfy the laws of thermodynamics, but we were used to entropy being associated with a count of quantum states, with the entropy of some quantum density matrix. And there was no understanding in classical general relativity of how we could calculate the entropy as a count of quantum states. Well, the ADS-CFT correspondence gives us a way to do that for black holes in anti-de Sitter space, and that also turns out to work for certain kinds of, the same calculation tells you something about certain kinds of extremal, almost supersymmetric black holes in ordinary flat space. But let me concentrate on the anti-de Sitter case. There's a formula that I can calculate in two completely different ways. Number one, I do the calculation using Bekenstein and Hawking's formula for entropy coming from classical general relativity. On the other hand, I say, oh no, Maldacena, Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Witten told me this theory as a quantum theory is a conformally invariant quantum theory, quantum field theory, and so I know how to calculate the entropy. And lo and behold, except in general for the order one coefficient outside, as a function of the energy and every other parameter you can stick into the theory, like various kinds of conserved charges, the formulas calculated from conformal field theory and calculated from the Bekenstein-Hawking formula coincide with each other. Okay. And this is basically what the formula looks like. This is for uncharged black holes. And there are a couple of important things about this formula. The most important, in my estimation, is the fact that this formula depends crucially on the radius of anti-de Sitter space in Planck units. That radius, remember, was simply the square root of minus the cosmological constant in Planck unit. And so the formula for the extreme asymptotic high energy density of states in the theory depends sensitively on the cosmological constant. What this, I think, tells you is several things. Number one, it says if I have different values, at least for negative values, of the cosmological constant, I've really got different Hamiltonians, not different states of the same Hamiltonian. The high energy behavior of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian depends on what the cosmological constant is. And indeed, when we think about these conformally invariant field theories, they're associated in many cases with things like supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. And in that case, it turns out that this ratio in Planck units of LADS to L Planck is just a power of n in an SUN gauge group that defines what the Hamiltonian of the theory is and depends basically on different cosmological constants, different theories. Okay. So that's number one. The cosmological constant is then generally a discrete parameter that at least partially characterizes what the Hamiltonian is. You can have two different Hamiltonians that have the same cosmological constant, but there's one thing about the Hamiltonian that the cosmological constant picks out. And then the other thing is that the whole idea of a low energy contribution to the cosmological constant, the idea that we naturally got by thinking about the renormalization group and effective field theory, is an oxymoron. It doesn't make any sense. The cosmological constant is a high energy parameter. It doesn't have anything to do with low energies. Low energies can't change what it is. Okay? So the things that we've been thinking about effective potentials and low energy contributions to the cosmological constant somehow seem to contradict what we've been learning. It's very funny that we're using field theory to contradict field theory. We're using our knowledge of field theory on the boundary of space-time to contradict our prejudices about field theory in the bulk of space-time. Okay. So now I've finished the part of my colloquium where at least the statements of fact that I made about string theory will be agreed with by most string theorists, though the last few words that I've said interpreting them are surely not agreed to by most string theorists. Now I want to tell you about how these ideas apply to a hypothetical theory, theory that does not yet exist, of...
Question.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
When you do your scattering experiment, there is a national direct link of the particles themselves that you prepare and they scatter and form the black hole. What is the balance in entropy between the entropy which is needed to prepare this particle? Because
usually the initial state is very low entropy. Okay. But, of course, when you pump a lot of energy into the system, you can excite a lot of high energy states, and that's what you do. You excite a very high energy, very high entropy black hole state.
So there is no entropy which is needed to create them, because you have to make them very accurate in time and space in order to scatter them.
Not terribly accurate. It's not terrible. It's nothing. Whenever you think about forming a black hole from ordinary matter in any way, the amount of entropy in the matter that falls in to make the black hole is always much, much less than the entropy in the black hole itself. By crossing this threshold, you suddenly, what happens is that the black hole, once you cross this threshold of very high energy states, then right nearby there are a huge set of very degenerate states. And that's where the entropy comes from. and you have to cross the threshold, make the black hole, and then once you're in one of those states, little perturbations can knock you around from one to the other. Okay, so we're not violating the second law of thermodynamics. The entropy is increasing in these processes.
Well,
so now I'd like to tell you first some classical and semi-classical facts about what is called De Sitter space. De Sitter space, just like anti-De Sitter space, was the most symmetric solution of Einstein's equations with a negative cosmological constant. De Sitter space is the most symmetric solution with a positive cosmological constant. And in fact, you can get the formulas for the metric that I'm going to write down by doing an analytic continuation in the cosmological constant. That doesn't mean the spaces have anything physically to do with each other. They're very, very different. So globally, De Sitter space is a manifold that it's nice to picture like this. It consists of a sphere, which in this picture is just a circle, which starts out at time minus infinity with infinite radius, comes contracting in exponentially to some minimum radius, and then expands out exponentially back to infinite radius again. So it's a kind of hyperboloid in spacetime. And that's what the global De Sitter geometry looks like. It has a natural length scale associated with it, which is the value of the square root of the cosmological constant in Planck units, and this corresponds to the size of this minimal radius that the sphere shrinks down to. So that's what some global observer, as we call it, would see. But in fact, no observer can actually see that. If I look at any observer following some time-like trajectory in this manifold, then what's going on is that the space-time geometry is stretching out and shrinking down at speeds faster than the speed of light. That's something, if you know about Einstein's theory, there's no rule that says that space can't stretch faster than the speed of light. Nothing can move through space faster than the speed of light, but geometry can stretch faster than the speed of light, and that causes the so-called phenomena, the phenomena of so-called horizons. Namely, in a space-time, you can often have regions which some given observer simply cannot see ever. And that's what happens to the inside of a black hole from the point of view of the external observer. In fact, what's happening there is the inside geometry is stretching out so fast that anything you throw in can't get back because it would have to travel faster than the speed of light. So what does a real observer see in De Sitter space? Well, we were talking about this violent exponential expansion of space, but in fact what happens is that for an observer just sitting on his world line and following a geodesic in De Sitter space, nothing happens whatsoever. The space-time looks like this. It's completely static, has what we call a time-like killing vector. It has a time that nothing depends on, okay? And everything looks pretty much like flat space except for these funny factors here and here. And those funny factors look pretty innocuous until you realize that at some point they do something crazy. This is a Lorentzian space-time metric, so it's minus dt squared plus dx squared. But suddenly, if I try to take r greater than r De Sitter, something crazy goes on, and the space and time coordinates swap with each other. That's the horizon. That's actually the place, r greater than r De Sitter. Beyond that point, the static observer can't really see. And if you think about what he does see, if he sends particles out from where he's sitting towards that place, it turns out that because this factor goes to zero as you approach that place, they seem to be going slower and slower, and they never ever get there. That's what he sees. Somebody looking at the global space-time geometry sees them going through that place into the rest of this geometry that he can't see. So that's classical fact number two. Classical fact number three is that there are black holes in De Sitter space. In fact, you get them from this metric by the same trick that works in flat space. You just add Newton's potential, or subtract minus g mm over r to the appropriate power, to this formula. Okay. Now, when you do that, you always, well, not always, I'll tell you in what conditions, but always when you're doing something sensible, you always find a second zero of this function over here, and that's the black hole's horizon. So there are black holes in De Sitter space which have a metric like this but with a Newtonian potential stuck in addition, and those black holes have two horizons, one that looks like the cosmological horizon of De Sitter space, the one that was there before you put the black hole in, and another one looks, when the black hole is small, just like the horizon of a black hole in ordinary flat space. But it's clear something very funny happens when those two horizons come and touch each other. And what happens is that the solution no longer makes sense above that point. And so there's a maximal mass for the black hole in De Sitter space. You can't have black holes larger than a certain mass. Furthermore, when I look at the area of the black hole horizon, and even add to it the area of the cosmological horizon that's there after I put the black hole in, even the sum of those two areas is smaller than the area of the original cosmological horizon before I put the black hole in. Now, when I go to my semi-classical facts, and I should have mentioned this, these are all facts that were established by Gary Gibbons and Stephen Hawking, I learned something really interesting from that last statement. Namely, Gibbons and Hawking, following Bekenstein and Hawking, identified the area of the De Sitter horizon with some kind of an entropy by the usual formula. This is area in Planck units, as usual. So that's one thing that they found. Second thing, they found that if I tried to put quantum field theory into De Sitter space, into this static patch, there's a nice Hamiltonian, a conserved energy for this static patch, because everything is time independent. And the state of quantum field theory was always a thermal density matrix with some temperature, sort of like a black hole. The difference being that empty De Sitter space doesn't decay because of that temperature, it just sort of sits there. Finally, when I think about black holes in De Sitter space, they eventually decay and go back to being empty De Sitter space. The particles emitted from the black hole go out towards the horizon, and eventually they get close enough that I want to say, okay, they're closer than the Planck distance from the horizon. I'm not going to think about them anymore. And so they become part of the empty De Sitter space. So black holes are unstable in De Sitter space as they are in flat spacetime. Here's the Penrose version of this diagram. This is the Penrose diagram for all of De Sitter space. This is time equals minus infinity. This is time equals plus infinity. Again, we've twisted and distorted. This is the, remember we had a sphere. This is 0 to pi for one polar angle of that sphere. And then you think of the whole thing being revolved in d minus 2 dimensions. This is the region seen by a single causal patch observer sitting at what I'll conventionally call the north pole of the sphere. And there's another patch for the south pole observer, and they never have any causal contact with each other. The rest of the space-time, well, if I think about the region up here towards plus infinity or down towards minus infinity, it seems to have zillions of copies of air volumes that are as big as the total that this guy can see. So it seems like at this time we're at the minimal radius and there are sort of only two copies of the degrees of freedom of a single observer. But up here, if I think about quantum field theory in this space-time, it seems like I need to have degrees of freedom here, 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 here. And the radius of the sphere up here is exponentially larger, eventually going to infinity, than the radius that this guy can see out to. So it seems like I would have to fill many, many spheres like that. Well, that idea of degrees of freedom outside the horizon leads you to trouble when you think about black holes. And there's a principle called complementarity for black holes, or more generally, observer complementarity, which has proved useful in thinking about the apparent paradoxes of black hole evaporation. And the principle is, if I give you a causally connected patch of any space-time, there should be a complete unitary quantum mechanical description of all of the physics in that space-time, just in terms of that patch. So that is useful both to think about the paradoxes of black hole evaporation, which in this talk I don't have enough time to tell you about, but also it fits in very nicely with this classical view that from the point of view of a static observer, both in a black hole or in de Sitter space, nothing ever really crosses his horizon. In the time that he uses, he can wait an infinite amount of time and everything just sits there, sitting on the horizon. So there should be, in this way of thinking, a way of associating all the degrees of freedom with the space-time with either things that he can see locally around him or things that are living on his horizon. And it's then natural that the horizon has an entropy corresponding to all of those states living there. So the conclusions that Willy Fischler and I came to putting together all of this stuff are the following. That indeed there should be a set of such horizon states. And in order to be consistent with the semi-classical thermal picture, you have to assume that the static energies of all of those horizon states are less than something of order this de Sitter temperature, so that they're all excited at this de Sitter temperature, and that those states have a random enough dynamics and coupling to more localized states in the space-time that are described by quantum field theory, that they can thermalize those localized states. Finally, from the fact that there's an upper bound on the energy, this upper bound on the black hole mass, and the fact that the entropy calculated by Gibbons and Hawking is finite, you conclude if the density matrix is thermal, there's an upper bound on the energy, and the entropy is finite, the number of states in the quantum theory has to be finite. Furthermore, that number of states changes as I change the cosmological constant. The area of the horizon is the area of a unit sphere times r to the d minus 2. R to the d minus 2, r is just the square root of the cosmological constant, the inverse square root of the cosmological constant in Planck units. And so the number of states is directly connected to the value of the cosmological constant. Again, we conclude, as we did for negative cosmological constant, that the cosmological constant is a discrete input parameter to your theory. When somebody gives you a quantum theory, they don't tell you to dynamically determine the number of states in the Hilbert space. There's a finite number of states. They tell you what the number of states is, and then you can figure out what the Hamiltonian is. But nobody says, we're going to dynamically determine the number of states. So it's an input parameter, just as it was for negative cosmological constant, but it has a rather different meaning. There, it had something to do with the behavior of the high energy density of an infinite set of states. Here, it's actually sort of a count of a finite number of states. And the final thing that one learns from putting these facts together. Remember I told you that when we put a black hole into de Sitter space, the entropy of everything goes down. So what that suggests is that you make stuff locally in de Sitter space by borrowing from the states on the horizon. Every time you try to make something big locally in de Sitter space, you've frozen the states on the horizon in de Sitter space to a very special class of states. If you don't do that, they're allowed to fluctuate freely. They have a large entropy. The more you want to see, the less the states on the horizon are allowed to fluctuate. The total is finite. Let me quickly finish up with some conclusions. I should say to you that it should be obvious from what I have said that we're very far from actually having a mathematical theory that completely describes de Sitter spacetimes. What we're working on is a way to put some more meat onto these ideas. So here's what I conclude from what I've told you today. First of all, there are many different mathematically consistent models of quantum field theory. Some of them may describe the real world, many of them don't. Effective field theory, and in particular the effective potential, are generally not good tools for classifying models of quantum gravity. Now, I made a big point of that, and I want to sort of retreat from it a little bit. Namely, I try to argue to you that there can be no exact concept in quantum gravity that corresponds to effective potentials and effective field theory, but that doesn't mean that they might not be an approximation to something else. So there might be some range of parameters in certain theories where you can use effective potentials to do calculations with. What we really have to understand is what is the limitation of this tool? Where can we use it? Where can't we? The place I think you really can't use it is to think of it as a method for determining what the cosmological constant is. In every model that we have understood, and I've just argued to you, perhaps in cases that we don't yet understand, the cosmological constant seems to be an input parameter which has something to do with the very high energy spectrum. It's telling you about the detailed spectrum of the Hamiltonian. It's the part of the definition of the theory. It's not a calculable low energy parameter. Finally, I believe that there's a good argument that there should be a quantum theory of stable de Sitter spaces, and that those are quantum systems with a finite number of quantum states. Now that's all I've been able to talk about in this colloquium. There are a couple of other interesting things that I'd just like to mention in passing. If you believe this, then there are some very interesting conclusions, which are interesting from the point of view of conceptual physics, though they don't really put any practical limitations on anything. If I have a finite quantum system, given what I told you at the beginning about making precise quantum measurements, you need infinite machines. You can't make infinite machines in a finite quantum system. And so that suggests that any theory of de Sitter space has a sort of intrinsic ambiguity in it. You can't make absolutely precise measurements. The world has a finite number of quantum states. Then trying to separate it into two parts and have one measure the other, at a certain point you'll be beaten by the quantum fluctuations in your measuring apparatus. It turns out that those effects are exponentially small as the cosmological constant goes to zero, and since the cosmological constant is 10 to the minus 120th, nobody in his right mind is ever going to worry experimentally about those restrictions on measurement. There are deep connections between all of what I've said and supersymmetry. This point here is basically for the string theorists. I think the lambda goes to zero limit may be a very highly constrained system, maybe even unique, and that may make this framework rather predictable. That's a conjecture. There are some reasonable arguments for it, but I wouldn't die if it turned out to be wrong. And finally, the picture that I've given you very heavily relied on this idea that ultimately, at very high energy, the fundamental degrees of freedom of any theory of quantum gravity have something to do with black holes. That any time you get a situation where you have very high energy densities, black holes are relevant, and you should think of physics in terms of what black holes do rather than in terms of what fields do or what particles do. And that has implications for what happens at cosmological singularities. And those of you who want to hear more about that, go to Willy Fischler's talk at the conference that we're going to be holding in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much. You get a larger black hole, which in four dimensions has
picture of the density of state, it remains consistent because it scales like the area.
That's right. So the entropy goes up by a factor of four if they both had equal mass, because the area goes like the mass squared. I'm talking about four dimensions now. Something interesting about that in general, in an arbitrary number of dimensions, is that the entropy always scales like a power of the energy greater than one, which means that the black holes have negative specific heat and they're thermodynamically unstable. Okay, that happens in asymptotically flat space, but not in asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. And that's why asymptotically anti-de Sitter space is well modeled by a normal quantum system like a quantum field theory. But asymptotically, flat space is a much more bizarre creature. Another piece of evidence that zero cosmological constant and finite negative cosmological constant are very, very different systems. Even though in an effective potential picture, it just looks like you're moving the bottom a little bit.
Yeah.
Did you address the conundrum of fine tuning? I thought that this statement that
yes.
effective field theory is not good was a statement that it wasn't a problem, but is that?
Okay, yes, I implicitly addressed it, but I didn't explicitly, so thank you for asking the question. So basically, in effective field theory, you always have this option of fine-tuning. And the question is, why should you do it? Okay. And the reason that we usually don't like to do it is we're thinking about properties of the theory that we think are properly determined at low energy. Okay. But what I've tried to show you is that, in fact, the cosmological constant is a high-energy input. So just as if I have a theory with a certain symmetry, which I don't know in principle until I've looked at the full high-energy theory and I know that it has that symmetry. Once I know it has that symmetry, I'm allowed to use that in constraining my low-energy effective Lagrangian. Okay? I can say, oh, this Lagrangian has to be rotation invariant because I know the full theory it came from had to be rotation invariant. Now I'm saying there's another high-energy property which is fundamental. Its input from high energy has nothing to do with low energy. You just have to fit the low energy effective Lagrangian so that it agrees with that high energy prediction. That's fine tuning, but it's fine tuning that you now understand that there was a good reason to do.
But it's still 120 orders of magnitude.
It's still 120 orders of magnitude. So what this says is that the 120 orders of magnitude is something that's put in by hand into the theory. It's a parameter. Now, if you like the anthropic principle, then there's a good argument that says it's got to be close to that, okay? But it may just be, another way of thinking about this is every physical theory that we've known up till now needed to have input data from experiment put in. And this
120 orders of
No, it's not unnatural. It's you're thinking about it in this effective field theory language where it was unnatural. But here it's not put in at that level. It's put in when I decide what's the quantum theory. So if it's negative, it has to do with choosing whether the gauge group is SU 257 million or SU some other large number. If it's positive, which is what it seems to be, it has to do with choosing a priori the number of quantum states that your theory has.
Okay, Mark?
As you know, there's a measured cosmological constant now, but it's also possible that it's in field theory language, a field that's rolling to zero.
Absolutely.
These considerations favor one of those scenarios over the other?
Okay, so the picture that I gave you of what De Sitter space might be depends on the cosmological constant being a cosmological constant, no rolling fields. The theory with rolling fields has an infinite number of degrees of freedom and so on. The question of whether this set of ideas bears on that has to do with stuff that's even more controversial than what I talked about. So one of the things that I've claimed is that the scale of supersymmetry breaking is determined in terms of the cosmological constant by a formula that's not the canonical one from supergravity. That idea depends on the cosmological constant being a real cosmological constant. It wouldn't work in a quintessence model. So if eventually we show that that idea really makes sense, and we can tie the observed, eventually, masses of superpartners to the cosmological constant by a reliable calculation, that'll be evidence against quintessence. Okay. I won't say anything more. There's another point, but I'll avoid it.
I'm going to allow myself a question.
Sure.
This is a question I asked you in private already.
Okay.
How does your very speculative paper from 20 years ago on the meaning of time fit into this picture?
Okay, that's a big question. It has to do with these issues about quantum mechanical measurement.
Okay.
Okay, so basically, that paper was based on what I consider an outmoded formalism for thinking about quantum gravity, but it had a grain of truth in it, which was the idea that in order to define time in a theory like general relativity, where fundamentally every time coordinate is good as any other, that you had to have some semi-classical thing, some object in the theory that was behaving approximately like a classical object in order to define what you meant by time. Okay. So that hooks into these ideas of measurement theory and needing very large Hilbert spaces in order to be able to make very large machines that behave almost classically. And that says that defining what the Hamiltonian is in a theory will depend on being able to do that and establish some set of classical variables that can... So just one understatement. In these mathematical examples we have of asymptotically flat or asymptotically anti-de Sitter spacetime, we see that very clearly because the Hamiltonian is described by the behavior of the theory on the boundary, and it doesn't care about the bulk, okay? It's defined in terms of things going on the boundary, and those are classical from the point of view of quantum gravity fluctuation.
Other questions? I especially encourage the young people to ask questions because some of these issues are probably going to be solved by the young people. No questions?
Okay. Now, Deborah told me that really the only excuse for this colloquium was to gather you all together so you could be sent down to the beach to the barbecue. So please all go.